Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight our topic of discussion is the British comedy series, The Thick of It. Joining me for tonight are Aaron White, say hello.
Hello.
And Hugh Kenneth David, say hello.
Hello.
Now, The Thick of It is, well, it's a comedy, and it ran for what are called four series. That's the British version of a season. And the interesting thing is that series one and two, when they were put on DVD, are sometimes sold as series one. This is because there are only six combined episodes, six total episodes. So you had two three-episode series. The series is only a half hour long. There are some hour-long specials and one regular episode of the series that was an hour. But for the most part, it is a half hour. There's only 23 episodes. It was mostly written and directed by Armando Iannucci, a very talented Scottish writer and producer. It stars the absolutely incredible Peter Capaldi as a character called Malcolm Tucker. It takes place in and around, well, not number 10 Downing Street, because this is not about the Prime Minister. Oh, no. This is about a low-level minister at a pretty shitty made-up department. And his eventual successor, and you also get the opposition coming in, and they're just as useless as the other guy and just as terrible and rotten all around. It reminds me a little bit, and then in some ways a lot, of course, the late, great Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister. Now, I had, of course, been familiar with Capaldi from other things he'd done, movies and TV shows. I heard about The Thick of It. I had not seen The Thick of It until after Peter Capaldi took on the role of the Doctor in Doctor Who. So I didn't come to The Thick of It until about 2014, 2015. So that's how I came to Doctor Who. But I want to know, guys, how did you come to Doctor Who? So, Hugh, how did you first come to The Thick of It? Sorry. Live radio, guys. Live radio. So how did you first come to The Thick of It, Hugh?
So two things. I was already a fan of Iannucci's work because I'd seen The Day-to-Day in the 90s, which was, you know, appointment viewing. You had to watch it. And absolutely hysterical, pushed the boundaries out of what we thought we would get from sketch comedy, as well as parodying news, media, politics. Just so much. And he was also part of a group of comedians trying to break new ground in British TV, including people like Charlie Brooker, who at the time was writing more than anything, but, you know, would come in to work with the industry later on, and a lot of the people we see as actors in The Thick of It are featured early on in other shows that Iannucci worked on. But I think the thing was, it wasn't just, oh, he's doing politics. It was also the way the BBC trailed it, because we'd already had The Office and we had had all these, you know, faux doc comedies that with no laugh track and which were very much harking back to 90s era HBO stuff. I mean, you know, the Iannucci's on record as saying that this is Yes Minister meets the Larry Sanders Show. And, you know, there was a few of these things that have given us, worn us quite thin by then. And so the trails of this were electric, electrifying. You just, oh my God, this looks great. And the fact that they leaked quite early on that they were basing Tucker on, amongst others, Alistair Campbell, who had quite the reputation at the time in the Labour government as their hatchet man internally, was just, you know, I remember one of the great British political sitcoms of the late 80s, early 90s, Drop the Dead Donkey, and that had that was an amazing show, and it did things that were it tackled things in a very interesting way using an office workplace sitcom. It was all political. It was based in a Sky News style newsroom, and it used to focus on the reporting and all the fake reporting, but also on the political side of things. So this felt like a throwback. This felt like a throwback to that. It felt like it was updating it. It was also updating it. And I just couldn't get enough of it. I mean, those trails hooked me straight in. And then, you know, you watch that first episode and it's just so good. So funny.
So what about you, Aaron? How did you come to the thick of it?
Let's see if I can retrace this acrobatically. In the Loop came out during the hiatus, right? So after the specials in 2007, but before Series 3. And I knew of In the Loop, though I did not see it. And then after Death of Stalin came out back in 2017, and I remembered In the Loop, and then remembered it was based on a TV show, and I went on iTunes, and both were coincidentally on sale. So I bought both and then sat on them until we decided to do the show. And then I binged through all of that on my break week 2 weeks ago while you guys were busy slugging through on Claudius. I was flying through the thick of it and having a wonderful time. So I actually did not come to it until very recently, but I have been aware of it and it's been on my radar for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. No, it's one that I've loved it. It had been on my radar, but I had just not had it to sit down and watch it. I knew that Veep was kind of the American version in a sense of the thick of it, but not really. And I had tried to watch Veep when it very first came out, and it just did not work for me. Now, that didn't totally put me off of ever seeing Thick of It, but I did think, well, maybe I'll just get to it eventually. Now, I do want to ask you, Hugh.
Mm-hmm.
What theme or themes do you think this show has? Let's just get that big one right out of the way at first.
Okay. I think that there's three that came back to me as I was rewatching it. I think the utter paralysis of modern British politics. I think there's a sense that anything that anybody ever wants to try and move anything forward at all, change anything, do anything, even the tiniest thing, they can't do it. There are so many obstacles in the way. And I think one of those key obstacles is another theme, which is the collusion of the media and the political establishment. The last couple of years, in particular in Britain, the movement in British people, in the British population to re-examine our relationship with the media. The fact that we have an entire city in this country that bans the Sun newspaper and it's not allowed to be sold in that area, it says a great deal about, and that's just that's been going for 20 years, but that's become the tip of a bigger iceberg. And then you add, phone hacking scandals, and you add, there's just a whole list of things. The press has lost huge amounts of public support and faith, and the internet is only one part of that, and the way that the media and the public prop each other up but also play the game of tearing each other down is brilliantly established in this show. That's far more important to everyone than actual day-to-day politics and doing anything that matters. And then finally, I think the other thing that I now really understand to be true due to various personal encounters and people I've met and things I've come across is the way that the two political parties basically are leading to each other. It's a one class and they function as such. You know, when they start to introduce the opposition office and the opposition PR team, it's almost like you are seeing a mirror image. There's not that much difference between them. The stakes are similar, the ideas are similar, the attitudes are similar, even though they're meant to be radically different. They're meant to be two sides of the ideological spectrum, and they're not. And I think that's very, very clearly shown. And something that's quite interesting, which I know for a fact from somebody I worked with who went off to become a political assistant, Chris Addison's character and his interactions with political assistants of the other party, that is 100% accurate. You know, they literally, like the guy when I'm thinking of, he was a history grad, he was doing a temp job alongside me doing a temp job at the local council here, and his mum was in the local council, and they were very much in local politics, and they used that connection to him to get our local MP, who's quite well known these days, because he was one of the architects of Brexit, and he's been he was one of the first to turn on Johnson, isn't he? He got this guy a job, and this guy came back to town for the drinks one evening. We're all just chatting and catching one another thing. So what's it like? And he said, oh, it's great. He says, all the political assistants, regardless of a party, we're all in the same WhatsApp group. We all talk to each other, blah, 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 blah. I was like, wait a minute. I was like, you're attached to a Tory MP. He's like, yeah, but you know, if he loses his seat next turn, that's fine. I'll just go and work for the other side. I was like, what? But that's the reality of it, right? That was 2015. You know, 2016. So that's what it's like. That the show gets that right, and the show is a good, 10 years ahead of that. Before, you know, in terms of showing to the world, this is how it works. It's all just blending into one big mush. You know.
Well, you know, the thing is I think it's very much the influence of the idea of the civil service over there in the UK, which, you know, we don't really have that. I mean, people call it the blob. There's a kind of civil service here in the United States, but it's much more politicized, and there's much more party loyalty and people resigning and getting fired and stuff. Than you'll find in a lot of other places. That is definitely something that I think is an interesting specific detail. But for me, I have to say, I really did think that one of the themes seemed to be power as performance. And that's mainly through Capaldi as Tucker. I mean, because what is Tucker but a performance? You know? And when he can't perform, he has no power. And once he has no power, there's no reason to perform. Now, that's not the only theme, but that's one of them that occurred to me. So what about you, Aaron?
I'm struggling to actually encapsulate a theme here. So I'm just going to talk for a second until something magic happens, which won't. So bear with me. But I watched this kind of through the filter as an American, through the filter of yes minister and yes prime minister, in which it kind of showed that the civil service ultimately is the group that runs the government, no matter who's in power. And so it becomes this giant blockage that stops anything from ever happening. But then the thick of it adds into that the shadow partisan power brokers. Like, I kept thinking, and this might should have been saved for later, but I don't care. I help anyway. Because he is that guy. Like, he was Malcolm Tucker in the Obama White House, right? He was the chief of staff for Obama, and he was the guy who, you know, let everybody have it when they needed it. And so on top of the civil service, which is alluded to and is alluded to in the character of Terry, who just...
Terry the blockage.
She's supposed to, but nothing more, and not until she's asked three times, and not until there's like six stamps of approval, unless it's something she wants done, and then she pushes it through at hyperspeed. So it uses the civil service, but it's more about the shadow partisan powers.
Right.
And Malcolm is that guy through, you know, the entire show. And then in the fourth series, oh, God, you're going to have to forgive me. I'm blanking on the Nutters.
Mannion?
Yeah. And what's funny is that he's the Tory, but he's not. Like, he's just this total hippie guy who's been trying to kind of moderate the Nutters, as they're called on this show, to probably avoid
libel. He's like a conservative hippie that was never cool.
Well, this is it. He's a generation. There's a particular generation of Tories that they've modeled him on, and he's three or four ministers in particular. And yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, and it's those guys who are, you know, long since gone and like Alan Thatcher.
And you know, the thing is you don't want to like Mannion, but there are moments where you actually do, and I'm not sure how much of that is down to the way the character's written, or how much depth the actor managed to put into it, but man, that is a great character. Go on. Sorry.
Well, and then you have, you know, Oliver and Susie's relationship, and you see how, as Hugh was saying, it's all one big political class, which here too, to various degrees. I mean, there's power politics, and then there's grassroots politics, and you really have to know who's who. But anyway, not to get into any of that, because that's just gross. So you have Oliver and you have Susie, and they're leaking information like sieves back and forth. And so then Tucker decides, oh, Oliver wants to get out of this relationship, but I'm not going to let him. Which is what's also happening to Susie on the other side, is that they're not letting them break up because they're getting too much good information out of this relationship. There's a theme, I guess, is the personal and the political and the intermingling of the two. The magic finally happened, guys.
There you go.
See, we knew you'd work up to it. But, so I did want to ask this question, and that is, what is the show's greatest strength, Hugh?
I think it's two things. I think it's dialogue, you know. It is that purest of British traditions. You know, it borderlines on Shakespeare in the speed at which things move, and the references that are made, and the popular culture, and the sense of things you need to know to follow along and understand. So I think that's when we talk about legacy, that's going to come up again. So I think that's probably my my first one. I think the other one, and I think this is a Iannucci hallmark going back to the 90s, and I think that's his... And it's not just him, it's the whole team with him, Jesse Armstrong, all of the writers. You know, I think it's the eye for a perfectly judged comic scenario. Because the actors, whether you love something that they ad-libbed or not, or it's something that was on the page, the point is that the scenario that is provided episode by episode that brings it all, you know, it's the traditional British sitcom format, right? And it's easy to forget that actually that's exactly what he's doing here. You know, half hours and, you know, there's an intro part and we start to see what the plot is going to be and then there's the big setup and then there's the little scenes that he sews that will come together at the end that will dismantle the entire thing. And in that sense, it's almost incredibly traditional, you know? And it's actually easy to miss that because of the fireworks. But it is incredibly well judged. It has, you know, it's as fine a sitcom as you will find, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you could call it a workplace comedy, but
well,
not
yeah,
really.
Same thing. Same thing. Well, it's all of those things, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, what they say, you mentioned Shakespeare, what they say, there's only 16 plots and Shakespeare used them all.
Well, this is the whole thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, Shakespeare, even though I finished teaching last week, Shakespeare's still on my mind. But it was just one of those things that again, there's a couple of things I mentioned when we come to Legacy regarding the legacy of this show, but it's been a while in British history since we had something. I think this is probably one of the last shows before the sheer fragmentation of viewing options has partially erased the idea of a central monoculture that is to some degree upheld by media channels. I think this is one of the last shows where quotations entered the language. You know,
Omni Shambles.
Right. There's so many elements, and it's not all Tuckerisms either. But in the same way, because I was having to do revision work with some GCSE kids on Macbeth, and I was just looking at the last act, and we're looking at Tomorrow and all that speech, that soliloquy, and I just was pointing out that there's at least four segments, if not six segments, of that soliloquy that each separately have entered the language over the years. They all, for good reason, and this show has done the same thing, you know.
Aaron,
I have a name for you, Ian Martin.
Ooh.
Yes,
he was the swearing consultant on this show. And he wrote all of the insults, all of the best ones. And that's all he did.
That was his job, to
write the most clever, harshest, cleverest insults in the history of television.
Yeah.
And he nailed it every single time. Not a single one
of
them fell flat.
You're like a skirt, except without a skirt or hair.
it's the writing. The strength of the show is the writing, and the fact that the actors could keep up with it. They let's not undersell the actors here because they're all tip top. From beginning to end. But still, the writing is the star. And the dialogue at that, for those who are dialogue junkies, for those who writing is just dialogue, not plot, it's all there. Like, and the writing is solid. The plots are great. The satire is sharp, but the dialogue is, as Hugh said, it's the fireworks. It's what you come for. It's what you stay for.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to switch gears for just a little bit. I'm going to ask this. There was, of course, a movie set in the or in a version of the Thick of It universe. It took the character of Malcolm Tucker, and it took some of the actors that had been in the show and cast them in different roles. It was called In the Loop, and it was up for an Academy Award for screenplay. But I do want to ask, now, Hugh, you've seen it, right?
No, I'm afraid I haven't. It's one of the ones, sadly, it passed me by. But I do have some interesting things to say about it because I was very aware of it the year it came out.
Mm.
And I've seen a lot of clips from it because they were pushing it very hard here in Britain. So it's weird because I feel like I've almost seen it, even though I haven't. Sorry, Andrew, Adam. Yeah, it's one of the, I haven't just
heard it. No. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I just over here in Britain, there was a real backlash to, there's always a backlash in Britain when talent goes over to America, right? There's this, we have this dual thing, and it very much comes out of movies and rock and roll, but even goes back to literature, this idea that, oh, we want our homegrown talent to be successful, but we don't want them to be too successful, right? We don't want them to, you know, everybody say, oh, you're going to break America, and then we don't actually really want that. We watch them fail. I mean, the New Musical Express used to, their motto used to be, we build them up, we knock them down. And that's how it works. Yeah, and that's literally how British politics and the movie work. But what I found interesting about everything I was seeing about In the Loop, the trailers, the clips, I was struck by the level of the cast, right? I thought, you know, for Iannucci to get the American talent he got on board, you know, I thought this has got to be good. And the fact that it then allowed them to spin off into Veep, to him for doing that, because even if Veep wasn't necessarily my cup of tea, and I know a lot of Brits who gave it a short shrift because they just were like, oh, it's like a watered down, think of it doesn't work. It held its own for all the years that it did, and I respect the effort that was put in. Like, it's not easy for an outsider. I mean, yeah, we've got loads of Brits who work in the American TV industry, right? But, you know, to do something like that, take them on something like that, and not simply fall flat on your face because you're an outsider looking in and you don't get it right. I've got a lot of time for that. I think it's an impressive thing to build a universe. You know, to build a universe where this is all happening. I mean, on the Borgen show, you know, we talked about the way Borgen subtly references the West Wing as being in the same universe, right? You know, it's nice to see the Thick of It saying, well, okay, look, you know, we're not just about England. We recognize that there is a world around this and there are other things happening. And so, well, you know, I think it was a big step forward and a brave step forward. And I also think the fact that it gave him the kudos to go on to make things like Death of Stalin, you know, David Copperfield. I mean, you know, he takes risks. And I think that's something worth, you know, that wouldn't have come about without In the Loop, I think.
Yeah, you know, speaking of Death of Stalin, because that's come up a couple times tonight, I have to say that the scene that will always stand out for me is where they're debating whether or not to wait for a doctor and whether or not to wait for a quorum. That scene just absolutely fucking kills me every single time.
It's just so good, isn't it? It's just,
Yeah. And the guy that played Barrow, oh, my God. But that guy's awesome. The best Falstaff I've ever seen, honestly. But he's a magnificent actor. Anyway, what about you, Aaron? I know that you just saw In the Loop, so what do you think of it? What do you have to say?
I love this. Honestly, I mean, this isn't going to make sense if you don't know exactly what I'm trying to communicate, I don't think. But I love the way that it was a purely British film that was trying to reach an American audience. I've never seen somebody really attempt that before, where they try to, as he says, it's watered down a little bit. It is definitely not the Thick of It, but it's also definitely not the Thick of It. And as I watched it, I told you this afternoon, I think it's the best movie I have ever seen based on a TV show. Because it's hard to pull that off. It's a tricky balance because you're trying to encapsulate something that can be 170 plus hours into two. And so trying to capture the spirit of a TV show and to do it justice while also making it a film that's digestible to somebody who hasn't seen the TV show is really, it's hard to do. Mr. Dan Harmon is busy telling everybody who will listen that that's exactly where he's at with the Community movie right now, is how to give it the fan service to the diehard fans while also making it easy to get into for somebody who hasn't seen the show.
You know, I'm going to tell you, there are two takes. Go on. Oh, sorry, go on.
And I think Iannucci and crew did that. I think they were smart to keep Malcolm Tucker. And I loved the way they played with the casting. The guy who plays Glenn, who was just kind of this bumbling old man in the thick of it. And he's great. He's really great. But he's this really confident elder statesman in the loop. And it's like, wait, what? It's just enough to kind of knock your homeostasis off. And so it keeps you watching, keeps you guessing. Even as a fan, like, it doesn't let you settle into the groove. Like, it's not just fan service. It's really letting you get into it.
Excuse me. So now the next question is going to be this, and it connects to some of the stuff we've been talking about. But, Hugh, I'll go back to you. Where does this fit in with Iannucci's work for you?
It's the midpoint. It's very much the transition point. It's the turning point between the British sketch show sitcom arena that he was very much established within, even if he'd already broken new ground, along with Chris Morris and Steve Coogan with, you know, Alan Partridge. You know, and also the radio work as well he does, you know.
Yeah.
He could have just carried on in those areas, as a lot of British talent does, and not gone anywhere or done anything else. You know, and get older and end up being on either doing reunion shows or, you know, just turning up as the guest on panel shows for the rest of his career. Do you know what I mean? That there's a lot of that that's happening right now. And the transition for some of these stand-up comics from, you know, doing comedy work to their own sitcom to the panel shows is so fast right now. You know, it's like before they're even 30. But for him to say, oh, you know what, I'm going to go out on a limb and try and do one of my favorite shows and modernize it, that's huge. And the fact that he was given a budget to go away, try and do that, let's see what happens. Brilliant, great. That's the kind of risk taking we don't have anymore in any British TV section. So,
well, you know,
there's
a lot of great talent over there in the UK, and I have to say, you know, there's a lot of strictly TV talent, and also guys that have made the jump from TV. Now, that's not to suggest that TV is a lower form, but just that it's a less budgeted form. It's a less budgeted form.
Absolutely.
You know, theatrical films tend to have a much larger budget, and they're a whole different beast. There's usually a lot more riding on them. And, you know, Iannucci, for me, is one of the ones that really has made that jump, but I do think that in a way the thick of it will probably for me always be his crown jewel. There's Edgar Wright.
The thing is,
I think you're right.
No, there was a delay, that's why we couldn't hear each other for a second.
Yeah, so I think you're right. I think that he's a standout British talent of this era, but also of the 90s, right? And I think where Edgar Wright has gone into, since bringing him up, you know, where he's gone from being particularly British to basically indulging all of his American genre passions in his movies that he's not doing with Peg and Frost. Iannucci's gone the other way. Iannucci has gone into making things that are interesting and relevant and to some degree groundbreaking, you know? I mean, maybe not in the most obvious of ways. I think, you know, when we start talking about, you know, you've got one question down that we're going to talk about later, which is, you know, understand our characters. And to me, that part of where I think he does something interesting with the show that we wouldn't have seen 30 years ago, 20 years ago. And I think it's the same thing with his films. It's a big deal for someone like him to take on a French comic book like The Desert Stalin that has the political aspect as well. And it's also to take on Dickens, that's a big deal these days, you know? And I just think it's his turning point. I think it's the turning point where he realizes he can work on a bigger canvas. It doesn't just have to be about England, as you say, Aaron. You know, he can do that thing of looking at America and saying, "Can I have a go at that?" Yep. Okay. Let's see how we do that. And he did something. And I think he's realizing he's got more to say to a wider audience and a bigger platform, and he starts looking for ways to do that. So
yeah, and you know, the thing is, I think you know, you got two other people that were really established in the 90s, in Stephen Moffat and Russell T. Davies. Now, Davies hasn't tried his hand at feature films that much, but Moffat has. Moffat found himself unable to catch on. I mean, he did the script for Tintin for Spielberg, but it was massively, massively rewritten. And he's never really been back. And you know, yet he's tried to bring, I think, a little bit of, along with Davies, a little bit of cinematic flair to television. You know, how many of the other people that emerged in the 90s as these comedy and drama showrunners have really done that? I mean, the UK is fertile ground, but there's not that many that have really been able to emerge. And the fact that Iannucci did the way he did it, I think, is special.
And he's still doing it, and I think that's remarkable.
Oh, yeah, and he's going to be around for a while. And granted, he came over here and he did Veep, and, you know, having a hit show on HBO doesn't hurt your chances to make movies. But to get back before I forget, this also ties into what I was going to say with to Aaron. You know, you had mentioned that there aren't many good movies that follow up on TV shows. Well, I'm going to point to the first Downton Abbey movie as giving the audience what they think the audience wanted, and what the audience clearly said, yeah, it's nice, but what was the point? And then you take a look at the second Downton Abbey movie, and that actually is what people wanted compared to the first film. And, you know, you're right. Most shows, when you try to take them to the big screen, particularly when you try to continue them in a big cinematic adventure, it just doesn't work. It falls flat, and I think that's partially because TV tends to be a much more intimate deal than a feature film. But we're getting away from it here a little. Now the next question that I want to ask. I'm completely losing it today. Aaron, you didn't get to answer that question. Sorry. Where do you weigh in on all this?
So I haven't seen anything did before Thick of It, so that kind of changes my perspective. Okay. But I see him as being kind of the marquee political satirist right now. Take away Sick of It, which, I mean, you shouldn't do because it's monolithic, but he made a Shakespearean tragedy out of the death of Stalin, and also it's laugh-out-loud funny, and also he did it by using only historically accurate quotes. So how? The death of Stalin should not exist, and it does, and it's amazing, and it doesn't make sense. And yeah, he did David Copperfield, which I did not get to see, but I have heard wonderful things about. So my view of him is strictly as a political satirist, and it leaves me wanting more. I have been very open with the fact that I think that political satire is mostly dead at this point in history, because satire relies on stretching the truth to just past or just before the point of absurdity, and the truth is already absurd at this point in reality. And so I find that science fiction right now is a better form of tweaking and pointing fingers and asking questions.
Yeah, and maybe
about
horror too.
Happening. But he's doing it. Like, he's still able to satirize the moment in a way that I don't see anyone else really managing. So I want him to keep going.
So, Hugh, here's the next question. If the show has a flaw, what is its greatest flaw?
I think it has, and this comes out of the kind of sketch shows that he was working on in the 90s and into the early 2000s. So Big Train and The Day to Day and a couple of others. But basically, because of the looser, more improvised elements to the work, you have to be very ruthless in the editing suite. And especially when you only have 29 minutes, although at least it is a full 29 minutes and no ad break, right? Because the BBC. And I find the half-hour episodes can be sometimes unrelenting, you know, and they can overload you. It's just this sheer overload that's hitting you of just, you know, vitriol and hatred and backstabbing. And sometimes, you know, if you're in the right mood, it's very, very funny, but you know, when you're binging it, it can sometimes be quite relentless. Interestingly enough, when they do the hour special, so effect, which was a, you know, effectively a third season, it was more of a holding pattern while they waited to see if their lead actor was, you know, going to survive, was going to be sentenced to jail or not, and in the end he was. Sadly prefigured by one of the lines his character actually says in season. But those specials are an hour long, and interestingly enough, while they give more room for the characters to bring more drama to happen in between the shock humor, they nevertheless were relentlessly depressing instead. So I'm not sure there's an answer to it, in the sense that fundamentally there are episodes where they have just jam-packed everything from the opening seconds to the final seconds before the opening credits. And sometimes even then, the audio of the final credits is making one last joke. It can be very, very, very intense. And sometimes it's fine. You know, sometimes that's what I'm there for. And then every now and then they don't quite nail it. And I'm not sure what the answer would be. I don't know if they had 45 minutes, if they would do any better, or if they would simply still try to keep cramming in more because of this take or that joke or that line, you know? So I don't know. I don't know. But I do think that there are episodes that overload you as an audience member. And I just feel like there would have been – I just think that
somebody who wasn't aiming so viciously for the jugular episode after episode might have allowed for a bit more breathing room or a bit more emotional content that would allow the audience to connect. Because, like I said, I know people like Addison's character, right? I know people not unlike the civil servants in question, and it's just, you know, it can be, but also some of the humor, some of the targets, the barbs that are put in the mouth of the characters are just so utterly, utterly horrible. And they represent a certain kind of person.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, yeah.
Like,
well, what's his name?
Hugh,
stuff, the guy that Oliver's fake girlfriend lives with. His flatmates with, I should say. He's just absolutely terrible.
He's horrible, and I know people like that. You know, I think he's the one who has the line, which is something goes something like, "It's like a bear raping a sheep, except not in a nice way." I was just like, "You can't say that." This is horrible. But, you know, I know people like that. I knew people like that. I know people like that. Now, I live in a Tory MP county. I know what this is like. And it's like, there are days when this is great entertainment. There are days when it's just like, this is reality, and I don't think I can deal with it anymore, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, he was kind of the geeky, nerdy guy, but not really
bright.
He was just into
the Star Wars and everything else. Do the movie
Star Wars,
thing,
Game of Thrones a little bit, even though it was just new newer at the time, and Harry Potter.
it is quite funny how they use all that. And I did think to myself today that actually there is a point where we really should do a Who Said It, Malcolm Tucker or the 12th Doctor, because there's at least three lines where Fowley gets to say things like. Like at one point he said, "Don't worry, this will make sense to you in 200 years time." And I was like, "Wait, is this Tucker or is this the Doctor?" I think it's the greatest flaw is the editing. I think the greatest flaw is the editing and the need to cram in.
Yeah,
I think they could have allowed them to read this.
So, Aaron, what about you? What do you think the greatest flaw of the show is?
I am still not sold on the fourth series partisan change. That first episode, the whole time, I just was like, okay, let's bring Malcolm back. It's one episode, but that one episode without Malcolm and Ollie especially, it's a little flat without their energy. But that's just about it. The only other thing I can think of is, and this is a negative by way of positive, is it left me wanting more. The way it ended was so unresolved that we're 10 years past it now, but I want one more. I want to know what happens to the parties as they go through the upheaval of the latest scandal. And I just want to see where everybody's at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and that'd be great, but where can you really take a guy like Malcolm Tucker, especially since
I don't see anything dead
or completely a nerd at this point. So, you know. the next question is going to be this one, and that is, other than Malcolm, who is a standout character on this show, Hugh?
Okay, so I think it's interesting. There's something here that actually reflects real life, interestingly. So the big breakout star from this was Chris Addison, right? He plays Ollie. This did his career so much good, right? I can't even begin to tell you how ubiquitous he became across TV and film. Huge. So, but I think that says a lot about the Boys Club of Britain, right, which is something that's parodied in the show, satirized in the show. And I think the women are actually, they're a much-needed counterbalance to begin with, but they grow to be some of the most superb characters. I think Terry, Joanna Scanlon, and Polly Kemp as Robin, I think those two grow over the first couple of years, and they are just not only brilliant, but I like the way that they... their responses and their reactions are so much more human and more like normal people, at least to a degree, right? And not like the political classes around them. And the fact that they also are there going, oh, my God, this is such a boys' club. Can you just get your balls out of the way and let us do the job? You know, that there's that one point in season three where Terry gets asked to go with Murray to see Tupper, and it's the first time she's been asked on one of these things. And they sit there, let, you know, Murray and Tucker are going back and forth with each other. And finally, it stops, and Tucker says, well, this is what you should do. And Terry gets out her pen and her paper, and she goes, oh, good, now there's something I can write down. He's like, what? And he's like, well, you know, all the rest of this was just expletives. Now there's something we can actually do. I was like, yeah, this is reality. This is what my partner feels like in her office job. And I think they're wonderfully portrayed. And I think what you guys were saying earlier, what you're saying, Aaron, about Terry and her, the degree to which she is such a civil servant. Although the irony of
she is the ultimate civil servant.
Although there is an interesting, the background of her being head of PR at the very prestigious supermarket chain here in Britain, Waitrose, makes me laugh so hard because I failed to get a job at Fox Studios in England one time. And the person who was interviewing me had only just been made head of marketing. And she had come from Britvic, which is a British company that makes soft drinks. So they own Schweppes, for example, although I think it's now owned by Coke or something. At the time, they still owned Schweppes. And they had a long, long-standing career history in Britain of, you know, family company that grew huge international success, soft drinks on every shelf. So she comes from the world of what was called FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods, right? And she was moving sideways into DVD. But because of the work she'd done in supermarkets, perfectly fine to work in home entertainment. Now, me, I was coming from DVD, an independent DVD, right? So we went through this very bizarre interview, and at the end of it, the feedback I didn't get a job. The feedback I got was, I don't think he's ever done marketing. And I've been working for 6 years in marketing at that point. And I was like, what the fuck? But her version of marketing was very specifically this managerial, I tell you to do something and you get on the phone and figure out how to do it and tell me how much it'll cost so I can say yes or no. It's not actually doing it yourself. And that's what these guys are like in that office. And she's, you know, Terry is that person. You know, I handle the supermarket's problems. I handle, you know, the scandal if milk didn't get, went off and was sold or something like that. You know, and for her, it's all matter of fact. And just really the way that then impacts with the politicians. Brilliant. And I think, and then after that, although we already knew she was a great comic actress, Rebecca Front coming in to replace Chris Langham after his arrest and trial, you know, she's great. I've watched her. I mean, she's another 90s comedic figure who has come up through the ranks and worked with Iannucci frequently over the years. But this is like a tour de force from her, you know? What she does with Murray and the way she puts the character out there in such a way that she becomes as much of a butt of the joke as Langham's Q had been, but with a much more human element to it, you know, a much more understandable, recognizable human being in there, whereas Hugh was so grim. You know, like just so grimly disconnected from both reality and his own family. There's a
yeah, Mara, you know, so I think she was the other brilliant standout. I think as the show grows, I think it's the women who really sort of come to the fore.
That's fair. That's fair. And you know, the show does take off. Not that those first six episodes aren't terrific, and they are, but the show really does take off with the specials and then series three. So you know, honestly, I'm going to have to say that a standout character for me, I'm just going to go with somebody that no one's. We've kind of mentioned him a little bit, but beyond Malcolm. Peter Mannion, I think that's just an absolutely terrific character that is so well played, and you really needed that really kind of droll, oh dear God, what now? I mean, he's constantly exasperated. Everybody's too stupid. Everybody's too annoying, and yet, if he was really as smart as he thinks he is, shouldn't he have known better than to follow these motherfuckers' bad advice? It's absolutely wonderful. It's a wonderful character. So what about you, Aaron? What's the standout character for you?
I have to go with Nicola Murray. She is such a good sport. Rebecca Front was such a good sport with that character, because there is not a single moment from the time that Nicola comes in to the time that she goes out that she's not just the butt of the joke. And they're good jokes, don't get me wrong, but she never gets to set it up. She never gets to be the straight man. She is the butt of every joke. And she plays it up like nobody's business. But yeah, I've got to agree with Hugh. Terry is also, that's another of my minor issues with series four, is that she's a little less involved. We don't see her as much. Once the Nutters take over, I mean, she's still there. She's still wreaking havoc in her slow, harmless ways, but she's not like
very slow
one
and not
of the
so harmless
characters in the same way she was. The hijinks much more belong to Glenn trying to fit in with the young MPs.
Can I just say poor Glenn?
Glenn is also great. I mean, he's horrible. But for those who've seen Parks and Recreation, he's Jerry. Just great character who everybody hates for no reason at all. Yeah, so Terry and Nicola and... yeah, Mannion's great. Ollie's great. There's a line. Malcolm steals Nicola's marquee speaker, and she's going to be using this event to kind of push her way up the party ladder. And Malcolm steals her special guest, and so she has to write a speech with 24 hours. And she and Ollie sit down, and he's like, we're going to rip this out. This is going to be fun. And she goes, it's like West Wing. And she goes, Ollie, you're not Josh. And he goes,
yeah,
yes,
that was
I am. Like a little chastened. But he
so
knows
good.
She's right.
Yeah, that episode is just so good. When Malcolm punches Glenn, I was like, I've been waiting. You know, it's like a thing you've been waiting to happen for so many episodes. Malcolm actually punch somebody, and then he does it at the worst possible moment when there's so many people around who can see what happens. It's like, you idiot, you know, but it's genius. So well done. That whole episode, and also the fact that they're supposed to be in Eastbourne, although they're actually filming in Brighton, which is a traditional Conservative Party conference venue. I used to live in Brighton, but I've been to Eastbourne as well, and they make some. There's a great joke at the expense of Eastbourne when Miles Jupp, who plays the press officer for the conference, and he's just so brilliantly rubbish, you know, total boys' school Oxford type who cannot do anything right or say anything right. And the bit where he says, welcome to Eastbourne, you know, this is the best of all of our shitty seaside towns. And I was just like, yep, somebody who knows exactly what they're talking about, you know, they just nail it right. But just everything about it, just the way it's just so English, you know, and they're trying to smuggle the speaker out. And Terry's there with the waterproof Mac up so in the hopes that no one will recognize it, but she's still got the dog in the car and she's getting the dog out. And, like, and, you know, Murray's like, oh, she put a dog in. And Ollie's like, yeah, not a good idea. Let me get on the phone. You know, starts yelling at her. And I was like, it's just so English, you know. Brilliant, brilliant stuff there. So.
Excuse me. So now we've kind of touched on this before, and I think I know where we're going to go, but is this show ultimately a triumph of writing, acting, or directing? Aaron?
I still have to say that the writing's the star, though I cannot give the actual stars, the actors, enough credit for keeping up with the scripts. And Iannucci directed, 17 of the 29 episodes? So that's a tour de force directorial achievement as well in a show that is so lightning-paced. It really is his vision that we're seeing. But gun to my head, it's the writing.
Mm-hmm. Hugh?
I think Aaron's right, fundamentally. But I would just like the combination of the three. I've said this before when we've done other shows, but I don't think it's a cop-out here for one particular reason. I think it's a triumph of all three because the difficulty of making faux documentary shows is... And it depends on how you make them, but I would hazard a guess, given this was a low-budget production and given the shots that we see edited together, I think this was done in the way that other 90s shows like Homicide were shot and Over Here, This Life, and things like that. The cast not only have to know the lines, they not only have to know the script, and obviously, as Aaron says, that is absolutely the bedrock of this show. But then they have to stay in character almost all the time the cameras are on. Because at any point, if the camera is looking at them, even though the main character delivering the main lines in the script at that point is elsewhere in the shot, if there's something is spotted, a reaction, a response that creates a laugh, the director will use it, or the producers will use it. So you can't switch off, right? Once the camera is rolling, you have to be in character, and you have to be ready to roll with changes, with ad-libs, and so... A huge part of making this kind of show work is that is all of those things at once. You know, it's knowing when to stick to the script and when not to. When you know your character well enough to be that character off script. When you know as a director that what you're seeing that's happening behind the main character the main speaker is something you need to include. You know. Especially if it's not something you staged. And I think that's what makes these shows work. Right? When faux doc shows work, they work because of all of that. And I think that's why this show works as well as it does.
Yeah. So, excuse me. Now, Aaron, what is your favorite story? What was your favorite story on this show? And that can be a storyline, either within an episode or over a few episodes. What was your favorite? Hello?
mind when you ask the question. So I'm going to stick with it. The Nutters go on a retreat to a hotel to do trust-building exercises and all kinds of weird stuff. And if that's not great enough, there's no cell reception. And all of a sudden, there is a big, massive thing that's happening with that's threatening to take everybody down. And they have to get cell phone reception. And the only place to get it is on top of the children's slide in the backyard of the hotel. And then photographs are leaked of Mannion and the Nutters Stewart version of Malcolm Tucker kind of fighting each other as they're jockeying for position for cell service on the slide. And it's among hundreds of jokes and visual gags, the one that made me, I think, laugh the hardest.
And then Mannion going, so you're supposed to be in charge of the look for this fucking party, and you didn't fucking think what we'd fucking look like, two grown men on top of a fucking children's slide in the fucking park? Or we needed a goddamn raincoat and a lollipop. I'm like, shit.
So good. So good.
So what about you, Hugh? Do you have a favorite story?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a favorite one anymore. Although rewatching it, I think I enjoyed the first, what we would call, as you said, being sold as one season, but the first two seasons of specials, I think those were groundbreaking. But mm-hmm. I did very much enjoy the Party Conference one, we just mentioned the Nick Lanai, so season three, episode whatever it was, episode three or four. I really enjoyed that one. And then the one before that where with the data leak, which is at The Guardian, which cracked me up no end because I've been to The Guardian. I used to work in advertising and marketing. So, the scene outside the building is taking place at the real building. And I just found that really funny in the way the whole thing was kind of plotted out. But no, in terms of actual episode, I think the special in which they realize that the Prime Minister is planning on leaving and they spend their time trying to figure out when he's leaving, except they then realize it's going to happen sooner than they think, and there's everyone playing off against everyone else and trying to find new climate candidates. That now stands as a hugely important piece of documentation because this is what we've been not hearing from the media for the last 4 weeks in British politics. Right? Like, this is what's going on. This is literally what's happening right now out there. And it was just so good to watch it and me go, oh, right, of course, this is what, this is why such and such happened, or this is why Trust said this, or this is why they pushed Morden, or what have you, This is why we had 10 candidates, just got whittled down to the two this week, and it's just like the insanity of the entire process, the idiocy of it, this person will appeal. Well, I mean, what about this person? And also, just the joy of watching, even if it's a fake Daily Mail editor, kept up on the phone all night long, having to change the story again and again. There's something really joyful about the guy in charge of one of those disgusting rags in the country, being made to suffer. I think that second hour special is probably at the moment at the top of my list right now. But
I really do like that two part transition between the first and second eras of the show. I'm really fond of that as well. That's really good stuff. Excuse me. Now, here's the next question, and that is, What were the influences on this show? What were its influences, Aaron?
No, I don't think that you could possibly overstate the importance of Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister, or The West Wing on this show. Those, I think, would probably be the two that stick out most to me. But they're also probably shows that I am most familiar with that it would be influenced by. There are certainly others. Obviously, The Office is a huge influence on it, just in the way it was made and the way it looks. But other than that, those probably are the big three that I can think of.
I think Aaron's pretty much nailed it. I mean, Iannucci's been, you know, he's done commentaries, he's done interviews, and some of the other writers as well. So they're all pretty clear on the influences of the shows that Aaron mentioned. I don't think we can underestimate the importance of Iannucci's own track record in the day-to-day, which parodied British news and journalism, the comedy show, the sketch shows Friday Night Armistice and Amanda Iannucci show, which was also a chat show, and his work with Alan Partridge, right, and Steve Coogan, this whole idea of this horrific leftover from the 60s radio DJ who doesn't realize what a conservative twat he's become. You know, and how cozy in Middle England is. I don't think we can underestimate how that plays into Iannucci's approach to politics and to looking at what's going on and to thinking about the audience. I think that's very, very important. Just trying to see. The other show I think that is important in the British context is there was a show in the 90s called... what it's called now. Chris Langham, the leading question we were talking about, he played Hugh in the first few. He was the star, whatever it was. People Like Us, that's what it's called People Like Us. And it was mid to late 90s, and it was a series of, I think it was two seasons of six episodes each on BBC Two. And I stumbled into it one night, and it was a faux documentary, but the thing was, it was so well done, and because most of the comedic actors at the time hadn't yet burst out onto the scene, I didn't know who they were, right? So I tuned in one night, and I literally just switched over and I was like, oh, what is this? And I, for about 5 minutes, I thought, is this really an actual fly on the wall documentary? Because it's very odd if it is, right? And then you realize, oh no, it's a parody. And the thing is that, so Langham plays a TV reporter and behind the camera, and you never see him. And each episode is a different job situation that he goes in and looks at. So hence the idea of People Like Us. You're looking at everyday people. And it was so brilliantly funny. They had one episode on estate agents. They had one on, the one that was very close to my heart was on teachers. And just like his character in The Thick of It, he has a whole terrible habit of trying to keep himself out of the situation, but then saying something when he really shouldn't to the wrong person at the wrong time, which precipitates horrific conclusions. Really very, very clever. And it only lasted two seasons. And that was a real groundbreaker at the time. I think it was 97 or 98. So I think that's ahead of The Office, that's ahead of all of these things. And I think that's one of the reasons I think they cast him as well. Because he was already quite adept at that kind of dialogue. So I think that's worth including. even if it wasn't sort of.
And well, now here's a kind of a relate. All these final questions are related, but Aaron, now what is the show's legacy to you?
I don't know. I know that as I watched it as the Boris Johnson government fell to shambles. In a way that I don't know if any other show I've ever watched has felt that wasn't commenting on the exact moment. Like, it felt prophetic in some ways. But I don't know. I think it's one of the most sharply executed political satires ever made in any medium. And if nothing else for American audiences, it gave Veep, which was a huge Emmy darling and a huge ratings monster, and everyone loves Julie Louis-Dreyfus. So if nothing else, that, though certainly I think more of it than that. So I have a hard time pinning down a legacy on this show, because I think comedies are harder to judge, especially modern ones. But
yeah. Yeah.
I think
you basically stole my thunder with that one. Yep.
Yeah.
So what about you, Hugh? Where do you fall on this show's legacy?
Okay. So I think there's I mentioned a couple of things earlier, so I'll come back to those now. So I think we talked about moving, you know, making the move to the U.S. Aaron's just mentioned it again, and I think it is one of those rare examples of crossover talent in Britain. We've had various sense of the years, and Aaron, you're talking about, you know, something that is made in Britain with a very strong eye on selling it to the Americans, right? And over the years, that's been done in so many different ways. You know, one of the reasons the Avengers moved to color in the 60s was to be able to sell it to the States. ITV also did, you know, one of the reasons the Gerry Anderson puppet shows had American voiceover actors was to sell it to the States, et cetera, et cetera. There's this long history of doing it, usually just by casting somebody, you know, in it. We had a cop show called Dempsey and Makepeace with a New York actor called Michael Brandon, and that was, you know, designed to be able to be sold beyond ITV. So there's always that, but it never really works. It's often quite messy, and it doesn't fit. It's so blatantly a commercial decision, not an artistic one. Whereas here, there is an almost seamless, not seamless, but you're using the interlude as a transitional moment, works in so many ways and for so many different reasons. And then, as you say, Veep is a success. So I think that's one thing. I think it's going to give more British talent the idea that they can make a move into either cinema or American TV and do it successfully. So there's that. I think Capaldi was apparently on the verge of quitting acting. So I think the fact that he got this role, huge. We can't argue, you know, that's huge. It's the role of a lifetime. He nails it. And unintentionally, he set the bar ridiculously high for Doctor Who. And one can debate whether or not he made it over that bar or not. And I think, and so giving Capaldi a new lease of life as a performer, I think that's huge. I think that's wonderful. He's obviously been one of our most idiosyncratic talents, so I think that's great. And I think the British MPs complained bitterly about this, right? Unlike Yes Minister, which had massive support from Prime Minister had massive support from Maggie's office at the time. You know, everyone in the Commons and the civil service would watch the show and then talk. It was real water cooler talk in an era before we had proper water coolers, you know. I said Britain, it's the cup of tea talk, isn't it? But one of the reactions to the thick of it was, oh, well, this is ridiculous. Why do you have to parody us? Why can't we? I remember one MP, I think it was a Labour MP, saying, well, why can't we have our West Wing? you know, why can't we have our Borg and why does it have to be this? And I remember yelling at the TV screen, going, oh, for goodness sake, you expect us to take you seriously? We, you know, we don't need the pick of it to see you guys like this. You know, this is how we see you. The pick of it is just telling you how we see you already, but also we know it's true. And I think, you know, I think its legacy, I think, was to reinvigorate the satirical tradition here in Britain. And I think people like Private Eye Magazine gained a new lease of life. I mean, right now, Private Eye Magazine, still carrying on, is actually one of the best sources of real news in Britain right now, horrifically. You know, it's supposed to be a satirical magazine, but right now you can read it and find out what really is going on in the halls of power. And that says a lot about where satire is right now in Britain. So I think the thick of it laid the foundation for that. And my final point is language, because we mentioned this earlier. I can't think of another show in the last, in this century in Britain, where the light, where phrases have passed into the vernacular, Shakespeare style. I really cannot. I mean, the one we always use in my house is come the fuck in or fuck the fuck up. You know, which I have to be careful I don't use at school. It's, I get, every time someone, a kid knocks on my door, I get so close to saying it. You know, but just the attitude and the phraseology and the ludicrous comparison. I think you brought back something that I think was a certain edge to comedy that we were starting to stand off in Britain. And the final point, final thing, you guys are going to love this. Right now, in my email box that came in 9 hours ago, okay, I am signed up to one of the services they use for populating the TV audiences on panel shows and comedies, so I can go to them live. So I've just received an invite for a new TV show, reality show for Channel 4, called Make Me Prime Minister. Okay. It will follow 12 ordinary yet opinionated Brits with views from across the political spectrum in a contest to see what it really takes to operate in the cutthroat world of politics. So the events are going to be hosted and judged by Baroness Saida Wasi, who is both a member of the House of Lords and the Tory Party, but recently became very popular because she did she's done Bake Off, she's done a stand-up comedy show where non-stand-up comedians had to learn how to be stand-ups. And with her will be former Tony Blair spokesman and inspiration for Malcolm Tucker, Alistair Campbell. So Campbell is now reduced to doing political reality shows with a Tory politician. This is, you know, like nobody would have thought to do this if there hadn't been the thick of it. Do you know what I mean? There's your legacy right there, is that what is Malcolm Tucker doing right now? He's doing reality TV.
Oh, yes. So, finally, we come to the last question of the evening, although that's almost the perfect note to go out on. We could do a whole show on that one. But, where do we rank this all time? For me, after my revisit, I had the show at 24. Oh, no, sorry, at 26. It was just outside my top 25. And it's now sitting right at 20. As with Hugh, my recent revisit made me really appreciate those first six episodes a lot more, because previously I was like, yeah, they were good, but the show didn't get great until those two specials. And I think that the show was always great. It just kicked up into a different gear with the specials. So that's me. Now, what about you, Aaron? Where do you have this all time?
13.
Ooh.
It blew my socks off episode one and didn't stop blowing them off until it was over.
Nice.
Well, very impressive.
And what about you, Hugh?
Comedies, top five. All-time shows, I would probably place it around, probably between you two guys, probably like 15, 17, something like that. I haven't worked, as you guys know, I don't do lists, but giving it some thought earlier today, you know, it's top 20 of all-time great shows, but comedies, top five.
Now we have come to the part of the show that I call housekeeping, and that's where we do a little bit of advertising for the next few episodes, and also what's coming up on Deviant Legion, and we'll get to that first. So on the 24th, which is Sunday, Rock This Town Radio with TC will be back with an episode entitled Where We Live. On the 1st, Carl and crew will be back with a Deviant Legion special entitled, What is the Best SFTV Program of the Millennium? Now, this show will be back as well. We will be back next week with a look at a movie that is and isn't television, a seven-hour work by the German filmmaker Siebert, entitled Our Hitler, a film from Germany. It is an experimental art film. It looks at times like it's a filmed stage play, but it isn't, and yet it is. It uses puppets, and it uses live actors, it uses footage and sound clips, it has people sitting, reading, it has people talking and playing at playing characters. It's almost impossible to describe it, but we're going to try next week to discuss this fucking thing. That will be followed on the 5th of August, because that's coming up on July 29th. And on the 5th of August, we'll be having our next director's spotlight, and that will be F.W. Murnau, the great silent director. Also, I guess there's a little German interlude this summer because he's a famous German director. He went to Hollywood, made a few films, and tragically died very young in a car accident. He made Sunrise, he made Nosferatu, and probably the only good version of Faust. Please join us then. But now I want to ask everyone what I always ask, and that is, Hugh, is there anything we haven't gotten to about The Thick of It that you'd like to mention really quickly?
Actually, no. We covered everything. Thank you for letting me get that email in at the end. That was like the one thing I was thinking, we don't have time for that. So, yeah, there you go. Everything is in there.
You're welcome. And you, Aaron?
The reality show that Hugh just told us about reminded me of one of my favorite lines in the show, which is when, and I can't remember who delivered the line, but someone told Malcolm Tucker, oh, it was Nicola, you used to be Simon Cowell, but now you're Piers Morgan. And it was, you used to be the guy that everyone loved to hate, but now you're just the guy that people hate. Just perfect.
Wait, no,
there are
two. Go on.
No, that was it.
No, I was just going to say, there are two things I want to say really quickly, and one is the penultimate episode of the series is a 1 hour. Episode in which various characters are brought before a committee, a panel, to answer questions because someone's died and the public must know. And, you know, it is one of the most perfect blends of comedy and drama I've seen on television ever. But the other one that I want to say, and I think this perfectly encapsulates the character of Malcolm, one of the other characters says, "You're bullying me. You're nothing but a bully." And he says, "What? What did you say?" "No, no, I'm not. I'm so much worse than a bully." And
yeah.
Hey, if that doesn't perfectly sum it up, then I don't know what does. But I do think that does pretty much wrap up the show. Again, as always, folks, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's streaming. It's on disc. It's easy to get a hold of. I think Amazon has the first 6 episodes, but it may be through like BritBox or Acorn.
Yeah. 7-day trial.
So definitely. Yep. It's a marvelous series. And as I said, only 23 episodes. You can get through it in about 12 or 13 hours. So not a huge commitment time-wise. So again, thank you everyone for listening. Thank you guys for coming in and taking part in this. And let's all be back here next week. So on the count of 3, we'll say goodnight. 1, 2, 3, goodnight.
Goodnight.